So Brooks Richards, are you on the phone?
Guegan, G-U-E-G-U-E-N. Guegan had subsequently to escape to Great Britain on his little boat, Pourquoi Pas, the boat that we'd met him on. And he arrived at Foy when I was serving with Holdsworth at Helford, and we collected off the security service the clothes in which he'd come, he and his fellow passenger had come, because we wanted them. Breton fisherman's clothes were hard to come by at that time, except from refugees such as he. And we were allowed to take over the Pourquoi Pas, which came down to Helford, though she was of no operational significance to us. We sailed her for fun down there. And as I say, I hadn't really realized until 40 years later why she was called Pourquoi Pas, or how old Guegan had been at the time when he did all this. And the boy on board was his youngest son, I think. All that is well documented in Guegan. Anyhow, that first operation was carried out, of course, still in summer conditions. And the next operation that we were confronted with was taking back to France one of de Gaulle's Free French, the earliest agents working for a specifically SOE purpose. The departures in 1940 had all been intelligence missions of one sort and another, and Joël Le Tac, our passenger, in the winter of 1941, had been parachuted into France in March 1941 as one of a team of four, all of them French parachutists who had been at Narvik in 1940 and who had arrived back in England and had volunteered to stay with de Gaulle. And this first operation, which is well documented in Michael Foote's book under the title Savannah, was arranged by Dick Barry, then a major, subsequently major general, who was head of SOE's operation division, because the RAF were very anxious to have any form of disruption possible of the activities of the Pathfinder, the German Luftwaffe Pathfinder squadron, based near Vannes in Brittany. And at the time, the intelligence indicated that the pilots of these Pathfinders, who were being used for things like the raid on Coventry, and who, of course, were the best navigators the Luftwaffe had, they went ahead and started fires and, to bring the other bombers in. They were being taken from Vannes, from their messing accommodation, out to the airport in private cars. And the Savannah team was supposed to attack the cars. Well, by the time they, in fact, got there, the situation had changed because they were traveling in a bus, and the bus was escorted, and they decided that they couldn't, in fact, attack them. The leader of the team was a Lieutenant Berger, B-R-G-E, Georges Berger, still alive, now a general. And Le Tac and the other two, one of whom was a man called Formant, Le Tac was only a sergeant at the time, were supposed to be taken out by fishing boat, by a boat called Breeze, who must have belonged to the Myler, little flotilla that I talked about earlier. That operation didn't materialize, and they were finally, two of them were picked up by a man called Jeffrey Appleyard, belonging to SOE, in a canoe, but he, unfortunately, two of the three canoes which he had taken along in a submarine for this operation had been lost on a previous night's attempt to get ashore. They'd ended on, they'd been carried with the tide onto the wrong beach, and these boats had been badly damaged. So he had only one. He could pick up two of the party of, in fact, three. Only one of the four had not got to the rendezvous, but Letac was left behind. And in that manner was still in France, in Paris, a month later, when a second operation called Josephine B was sent in with the object of destroying the transformers of the German, supplying current to the German submarine base at Bordeaux, at a place called Pessac. All this is well written up. But Letac came back to Great Britain after that successful attack. It was the first SOE sabotage in France that had been successfully executed. And I'm not absolutely sure by what means he got back to England, by fishing boat or whether he came back through Spain. But at any rate, he was in the autumn of 1941. He was had been given the mission of organizing a circuit in Brittany for the Free French and SOE's RF section, with in particular to organize sea reception, a reception of transport by sea, the transport being provided by Holdsworth and the Helford Flotilla. As Letac's parents had a house on the river at the entrance to the Abubinwa River, which is just before the channel leading down between the mainland and Ushant begins on the north coast, and this house had not been requisitioned, it was well placed, or seemed at the time well placed, for such a purpose. And we took him back on October the 14th, 1940, in 360, with a second chap who was his radio operator.
This is October 41.
October 41. And we had some preliminary training at Helford with them, but the second... the radio operator knew really nothing about boats, and it was decided the best thing to do was to lash two of the collapsible canoes we had, a type called foal boat, to lash them together catamaran fashion, with by tying a spar across the two and lashing underneath the boat, so that the risk of this fellow and his radio set overturning in one of the canoes would be minimized. So anyway, we took him down in 360 in rather rough weather, and went to the boy at the entrance to the Abubinwa River, a boy called La Fourche, and we slipped the canoes into the water and sent them off into the night, and returned to England. The weather had been bad enough that night for Holdsworth to, in his report, to say really that 360 was at the extreme limit of her operational capability, small as she was. Particularly as we had to do this rather tricky business of refueling the tank from drums while we were over there. And this was rather messy, slippery business with a lot of diesel oil. If you spilt anything, it then was in the cockpit of poor little 360, and people went sliding on it. And anyhow, with winter weather coming on, we were not entirely displeased when we heard that NIDC, as SOCOM's organization was then called, hoped to be able to provide a gunboat for the follow-up operation that we were expecting. And in due course, towards the end of December 1940, via radio contact that had been established with Letak, we went back expecting to pick him up. Well, we were given use of a C-class motor gunboat, a vessel of about 112 feet, of higher speed than the classic Fairmile B-class. And I may say there was an A-class of which only two prototypes were built, and we tried working with them in the summer of 1941, but they were so unreliable, one of them, that the one that we got use of, that it never actually did an operation. But the C-class ones were altogether a better proposition, and could do about 22 knots. And this was commanded by a chap called Dunstan Curtis, who became a great friend of mine subsequently, and a good deal of whose subsequent activities is recorded by Hampshire in secret navies, because though 314 was lost at in the San Jose raid in March 1942, where she was in fact the flagship, the command vessel, and Curtis's next command, 501, a vessel built, in fact, for the Turkish Navy that Slocum had been allowed to take over, which blew up owing to a gas explosion on board very soon after he assumed command. He subsequently became a figure of some importance in as one of the figures, one of the leaders and organizers of the assault group that NID organized to go ashore and take physical charge of anything of intelligence importance at the time of Allied raids or landing operations. This is something the Germans already had in 1940, and we decided in due course that we'd have to copy. And he was employed in that capacity in the landings in North Africa, in Italy, in Normandy, and right throughout Germany. But Dunstan, a delightful fellow, and the first night we went hoping to meet Joël Letak and his canoe, no one was at the rendezvous, but we habitually had a three-night arrangement. We would go second and a third night. And so we were down there the second night, and in due course, not Joël Letak, but his brother Yves, appeared in the canoe with another character who scrambled on board, and Joël explained to us that there would have to be another operation because Joël wasn't ready to leave and he would have some further passengers to bring off. But this was a chap called Fred Scamaroni. Would you please take him back to England? Well, it was agreed we would come back for a third time, and Scamaroni had arrived from Dakar and where he'd been sent to try and organize sympathy for the Free French, and he hadn't had much luck. And he came back, and he subsequently was sent into Corsica, with which I had a good deal to deal to do later on, by de Gaulle, where he was captured by the Italian secret police, the OVRA, and executed. He was a Corsican origin himself, Scamarini, as the name would seem to indicate. Anyhow, we took him back and organized a second operation, which must have been on, let me get this right, the operation with Scamarini must have been not, as some of the books say, the 30th of December, I think it was the 31st, for a very good and sufficient reason, that when we were approaching the Brittany coast at 11 o'clock by our time, we suddenly saw the coast illuminated by anti-aircraft being shot off in all directions from Brest, tracer going up, and from batteries on the coast, and searchlights, and we concluded that either we'd been spotted or that there was a major raid on. And so Curtis stopped the engines of 314, and we drifted for about a quarter of an hour in this strong flood tide, about 6 knots. But after a quarter of an hour, all was quiet again, so we resumed our so-called silent approach, which was on small engines, about 9 knots, and went in to the rendezvous. And we had on this occasion to go in further inshore. Now, the date of that operation is it's the beginning of February 1942. Stop.
Yes, I think you found it.
I found it. We picked up. Stop again. The third overcloud operation took place in early January 1942, and as there were going to be a large number of passengers, it was arranged that the gunboat, still again 314, would be taken into the upper Benoit estuary to an anchorage where she would be no more than half a mile from an island called Île Genoc, or Genyoc, both names used, which is joined to the mainland at low water, but an island at high tide. And the Lattaques had arranged to ferry their passengers over to Genyoc by canoe from their parents' house, the other side of the estuary. But we turned up with our two little boats that were small yachts dinghies, which could take one passenger in the bow and one passenger in the stern and a rower in the middle only. And, of course, as we found a party amounting to 7 on the beach, we couldn't get them all off in one go. We had to go back for a second trip. I think, having taken off 4, we got them all off in two goes, but this lasted till 3 o'clock in the morning, which meant we were far from home by the time daybreak broke. And we vowed we'd never do another operation in such unsuitable small boats. So the problem was to find something more seaworthy and capacious. And there really was nothing available at the time, so I went to work and designed a 14-foot plywood dory, very much of the shape and general shape and size of the dories used by the Grand Banks fishermen, the French Saint-Malo fishermen, for cod fishery. And the particular thing about the dory that attracted me was that they were nested like teacups, one inside the other. You took the thwarts out and you could then stack one on top of another, so that we could carry two boats in the space one would be occupied, either on a fishing boat covered by tarpaulin on deck, or one inside the other on a high-speed craft like 314. And we still had got no more money for building boats or converting boats, so I went back to Percy Mitchell's yard at Mevagissey and said, "Percy, I don't know where the money is coming from this, but would you build me these two dinghies? And I'll see you get paid. If necessary, I have to pay them myself." And he turned them out very quickly, but not in time for the third operation, when we took Joliet Tech back in February, beginning of February 1944, again with 314, using canoes again to put him ashore. And that was the last that we saw of Joel until after the war, because as a result of poor security, his circuit had been in contact with, through a student at Rennes University who belonged to an intelligence group and also belonged to Joel Attack's group. And the Germans in raid got on to Joel and arrested him and his brother, and he was sent off into a concentration camp with his brother. And this was a great setback, because it was the reception party to which Holdsworth and I had been counting to work. And we set to work thereafter trying to see what could be done with fishing boats down the Bay of Biscay, and using Mutin and Denise Louise. And for this purpose, we had these boats painted naval grey, and they were given naval numbers as motor fishing vessel 2014 or whatever on their sides. They were supposed to be some form of fishery patrol based in Hilford, but for operational purposes they were taken off down to one of the Scilly Island anchorages, a place called Great Ganelie, which is secluded, and there they could be repainted into fishing boat colours and have numbers painted on their sides. And in due course they would then have to set off, and it was necessary to sail really in the middle of the day, because neither of the boats could do more than 8 knots, and it was full 10 or 12 hours steaming to get across to Ushant, and the type of boat we represented at that time couldn't fish north of Ushant, so that we needed to be south of that line before daybreak on day two of the operation. So we set off and spent some daylight hours, well, 6 or 7 daylight hours at least, during which we were supposed to be escorted by a bow fighter from this naval base, where Bill Luard had taken up residence was able to identify, with the help of Peak and Sergeant Peak and others, the boats that were photographed by 54 Squadron Coastal Command as they flew up and down that coast, either on bombing missions or their other legitimate business. So we had a good idea who was at sea and what they looked like, and we could take the identity, and colours at least, of boats that were actually going to sea at the time. But we had misfortunes. The first two fishing boat operations we attempted with Mutin, we had an engine breakdown. We put a big engine in her, to give her a decent 8 knots, something far better than the original French naval installation would have done. This had been taken off a half-finished yacht belonging to Ettore Bugatti, the manufacturer of cars, being towed into England from Deauville at the fall of France. And we got one of these Deutz engines. And though she was, therefore, a sailing vessel, she could keep from getting too close to vessels she didn't want to by using her engine as well. And we had an engine breakdown, forced us to come back. Then we tried the next operation with Denise Louise, and that met with misfortune. Though I and Holdsworth were personally very lucky, because we had a problem that obviously it would have been desirable to have some form of armour around on deck, so that if one got shot up by a German aircraft, one could take shelter behind it. But and indeed Holdsworth had lost one man previously on Mutin, who'd been one of the pilotes de la flotte who'd come over in Mutin in 1940, and he'd volunteered to serve with Holdsworth before I joined him. But he was shot up not very far off the Cornish coast, and this man, Jean Piron, was killed. Anyway, we were a good deal preoccupied by how to give ourselves a little protection against machine gunning if we were caught in the area where we had no business to be as a fisherman at the time. And the only thing that was available was concrete to put around the wheelhouse. Well, of course, if it had concrete bolted on, slabs of concrete, it no longer looked like a fishing boat. So I wanted to get hold of non-magnetic armour. Non-magnetic because the only compass on such a boat was mounted in the wheelhouse roof, and if you put a lot of extra steel around underneath it, you made the compensating of the compass really very difficult. And I wanted non-magnetic armour, and they said, oh, far too expensive. That would cost about £600, do you realise? However, a couple of well-bestowed bottles of whiskey on the petty officer in charge of the naval side of dockyard repairs at Falmouth got us some non-magnetic armour put in place. And on the first operation with Denise Louise, we were barely 20 miles off the Scillies when we were due to be picked up at the limit of what was the fishing area around the Wolf Rock that boats from Newlyn used by a bow fighter. And at the right time, the bow fighter came, an aircraft appeared and came in towards us. We fired the recognition signal, but instead of firing the recognition signal back, as was expected, we were strafed from end to end by 20mm cannon. It was, in fact, a Fokker Wolf, which end on looks very like a bow fighter. And he came round and gave us a second dose. And fortunately, Jerry and I were able to take shelter behind the wheelhouse armour, and consequently were perfectly all right. One chap on deck was killed. He didn't die immediately outright, but he was dead by the time we got into the Scillies. But we had, therefore, to turn back and take him in and try and save his life. And John Newton was absolutely valiant in trying to staunch